everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Ilan Baron, who teaches at Durham University. Here to talk about his new book, Obligation in Exile, The Jewish Diaspora, Israel, and Critique, published this year by Edinburgh University Press. Ilan, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So, Ilan, you write in International Political Theory. Tell us, what is political obligation?
Right. So political obligation is the term used by political theorists to explain the general problem or the general question of why anybody would obey the law or obey the authority or the institutions of the state. And it generally pertains exclusively to citizens or permanent residents.
And political obligation goes beyond just loyalty. Is that right?
Well, the literature on political obligation is concerned with the question, why would anybody obey the law or why would anybody obey the institutions of the state? And the questions of loyalty can figure into it. It's a very particular problem that the term refers to a very particular problem that you would probably only come across if you're reading political theory of political obligation. More generally, it pertains to the relationship that individuals have to their state.
Okay, so political obligation is the idea that individuals should obey the laws set by the institutions of that state. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it explores that question, that normative question. Why would you or why should you?
Okay. And what have scholars written about political obligation, and what issue until now have they not addressed that you are interested in?
Right. So that's a very good question, because actually it gets to the heart of what part of what I was trying to do in the book. There's a lot of literature on political obligation. It's very, very extensive, and it ranges from theoretical literature that's concerned about the law to social contract literature to questions over various forms of individual state relations and how you'd explain that. What the political obligation literature does not do is address questions of an international or transnational nature. So what I mean by that is political obligation is always, as a term, is always restricted by the relationship that individuals will have to their state. It's not concerned with the relationships that people, communities, or individuals will have to another political community that is not their state. So say in the case that I'm concerned with, two diaspora Jews having a political relationship to Israel.
Uh-huh. So very generally, that is identity, right? That's the missing piece?
For me, yes. Theories of political obligation don't say very much about identity. They generally take identity for granted and subsume it under the general category of membership, usually citizenship. There's variations of that. But yeah, there isn't a lot about identity in the literature on political obligation.
And so the discussion until now about political obligation can't really account for Jewish diaspora identity politics. Is that right?
It can't account for it because it's not designed to account for it. And that's part of what I was trying to do in the book is an accident. It's a product of being interested in a particular form of literature, the literature on obligation and ethics and actually war is where I started. And finding that the literature didn't really take identity seriously, and then seeing that from my own experience that it seemed pretty obvious that there was an obligation type of relationship that characterized the Jewish diaspora's relationship with Israel. So what I thought was, well, why can't the political obligation literature help explain this? You know, it seems to be a relationship that is characterized by both politics and obligation. And that's where I come in with the using the word obligation and engaging with some of that literature.
Mm-hmm. So what I think you're saying is, you have more than half of world Jewry living across the globe. Many of them don't speak Hebrew. What political theoretical construct tells us that they should care about Israel? Is that right?
Yes, there's two questions here. One question is how do we explain this relationship? What are the features, if you will, that define the relationship relationship between diaspora Jews in Israel? And then the second question is the ought. So what should diaspora Jews feel, do, etc. insofar as Israel is concerned? You know, what positions should diaspora Jews hold? What should they do? What should they believe? You know, those sorts of questions. So there is what I wanted to do in this book was to separate those two questions. On the one hand, I want to have a better understanding of it, and there's autobiographical reasons for this, which we can get into if you like. There's about trying to explain the character of the relationship, and then there's the normative question.
Okay. Yeah, you were very upfront about your personal journey that led to write the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so most of my research has always been influenced, if not all of my research has always been influenced by questions of a very personal nature in some form or another. And this book is, I guess, the most explicit text in which I reveal those influences. There's two related things I want to do in this. One is a methodological discussion about recognizing the significance of a reflexive research project where you're highlighting your own role, how who you are shapes your research project, and how through the process of the research project that then comes to, you can then use that product, that research as a kind of reflective exercise. So that's part of what's going on there. The other part is just very much a personal journey, that having grown up in the West Coast of Canada, and attended a Zionist, a labor Zionist summer camp run by Habanim Dror, Israel was always very, very central for me in a variety of ways through the camp, and also through family connections and friends, and to an extent through the Jewish community. I mean, the synagogue that I attended, when I attended, you would have on, I guess up in the Bima, you would have, or no, to the right and left of the Bima, there would be a Canadian flag and an Israeli flag. Israel was always very central. And there was always the expectation that you would have to have a relationship with Israel, and that the relationship was a positive one. And positive could be support, it could be critical support, it could vary, but it was just assumed. And over time, the more that I read and studied and thought about Zionism and Israeli history and Israeli politics, the less satisfied I became with that assumption that somehow just by being Jewish, you're expected to hold a positive relationship with Israel. So I wanted to explore that. And eventually that led to this book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's get into the chapters a little bit. Chapter one begins with the Damascus affair. What was that, and why is it important to your story?
Right, so the Damascus affair was a case in 1840 which involved a Christian. It was a blood libel case. It's somewhat complicated, but the short of it is that you had a blood libel accusation directed towards a Jewish community in Damascus, and at the time in France, and to a lesser extent in England, you had a growing sense of Jewish concern for Jews in other countries. So what happened to the Damascus affair was you have this blood libel accusation being targeted against the Jewish community in Damascus, and Jews in France and England become involved to try to help their Jewish, Jewish brethren in Damascus. They actually, there's a missionist sent out there, and they try to help their fellow Jews in Damascus. And why it's significant for me is because it demonstrates a initial and very public attempt by the Jews in one country to influence the politics of another country for the sake of their fellow Jews there, that their Jews are under attack and we need to help them. And this used to be called Jewish internationalism. And it's interesting because it's a precursor to the kind of political relationships that I think many Jews have today with Israel, and also to a lesser extent, well, maybe not always to a lesser extent, but also with the Jews in other countries, that we have a bond, we're part of the same people, and if they're in trouble, we should help them. But what interests me about this case is was its very explicit political character.
Mm-hmm. And so is this an early example of trans? Okay, is this an early example of transnational political obligation?
I would say so. I think it is. The term at the time was international, the term that we would use more generally is internationalism, Jewish internationalism. But I think it is exactly the kind of transnational political obligation that I think we see today with Israel. Let me rephrase that. It's not necessarily one of the key features of that particular example, and one of the features that characterized Jewish internationalism in the 19th century was a sense of European superiority. That, you know, the Jews of Western Europe were privileged to a form of Western government and a form of Western sensibility, kind of enlightenment rationality that the Jews in other countries didn't have, and because of that, we could help them. That sentiment is no longer relevant, I think, for diaspora Israel relations. But outside of that, I think that there is something very similar, that you have there's a relationship that you have with your Jews in another country, and the relationship can be acted upon in political ways where you're trying to help them or support them as you are able to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you say the main flashpoints of the Israel-diaspora relationship pertain to security, political practice, and identity. What do you mean by those?
I'm sorry, the main flashpoint?
Of the Israel-diaspora relationship or debate pertain to security, political practice, and identity. What do you mean by those?
Yes, the main flashpoints. So the main flag, these pertain, if you think about debate over Israel, and you don't have to think about this in an academic context, if you just think about it, what happens, say, over Shabbat dinner or at shul, and you think about the debates that go on and what you can say and what you can't say and how emotional it gets, I identify that this list of key flashpoints, right, security being obviously one of them, and the part of the question becomes why? Why? You know, why is it so difficult to have a conversation on these topics? Why is it so difficult to have a conversation about Israel? And the late David Twersky said, and I quote him in the book, how we tend to get hysterical about Israel. And I think that he's right, that it can be very difficult to have a conversation about what's going on in Israel. And I think it's worth asking ourselves why that is the case. And I think if we think about what's going on in terms of an obligation, it, at least for me, it helps a bit in trying to clear out what's going on, why these topics are such flashpoints for debate, and why it can be so difficult to have a conversation about Israel and about what goes on there. And then obviously the question becomes, so what do we do? I mean, I was in Israel over the summer, and I was there when there was the arson attack and murder of the Palestinian family, and when the student was stabbed in the gay pride parade in Jerusalem. I wasn't at both of those events, but I was in Jerusalem at the time, and I remember following very closely the reactions, and one of the reactions that I heard from a few different quarters outside of Israel and also within Israel was how, you know, there may be extremist Jews who are committing acts of murder, in this case arson and murder, but we don't name our streets after murderers, and it became a very, very, there was a lot of I'm trying to think of the best way to put it. There was an effort to mitigate any sort of responsibility, that this was awful, and then there would have to be a but. There's always a but. And I think it's important that we ask why we feel the need to add that caveat. So the book is trying to, it, what I want to do in this book is enable people to think through the relationship differently so that we can ask those difficult questions and then see where those conversations take us.
Is the difficulty of having those conversations a recent phenomenon? Meaning, was there ever a time where it was possible to have these difficult conversations?
Well, I think the conversations have always been there, and there's been I think you see certainly with historical work, there's been some recent books that look at the writings of Simon Rabinovitch, that where you do see past debate. And of course, there's Hannah Arendt's writings, her Jewish writings, and there's no shortage of debate. It's more the character of it that I find peculiar, and also the sense that the debates haven't changed very much. We're still having the same conversation, right? But once Israel became a de facto reality, it in a sense precluded the opportunity for thinking differently about how, as Jews, we should understand our place within certain political institutions. It just Israel changed that conversation, and it especially changed it internationally. But it also didn't change the way over time that we understood who we are. You know, it's the usual phrase, a very important one, about how Israel is incredibly important, which I think it is. It's an incredibly important event for its creation is an incredibly important event for the Jewish people and Jewish history. And I think that I'm not questioning that. That's undoubtedly true. But it also meant that how can you question this, right? Where's the critical debate? You have to already start as a Zionist in order to start to question or to interrogate the relationship that the diaspora Jews should have with Israel. And sometimes there's more room for debate, sometimes there's less room for debate, but we haven't moved on. We're still having the same general kind of conversations. And I think that worries me. It troubles me that I feel we're running around in circles, and the normative discussions, the moral discussions about Israel are sort of stagnated into a set of very extreme positions where you just have to be kind of Israel right or wrong, or you end up in some kind of boycott BDS type of alternative or anti-Israel alternative. And I don't think either of those polls are especially helpful.
Let's move to chapter 3, which takes us into the empirical section of the book. Tell us about the methods you used. You did interviews, is that right? And what did you find?
Yeah, so the interviews took place over a few years because I was working at the time, so I couldn't just go away and do field work over one period of over a month or two. And the interviews, when I started doing the interviews, I was asking very much questions about obligation, much like we started our conversation. And as the interviews progressed, I kind of dropped that because the language of political obligation didn't really seem to fit very well with the issues I was interested about. There's a discrepancy in between the terms that you'd use as a political theorist and the terms that we would use outside of academia. So that was very interesting initially, that it highlighted a methodological question about how would you, as a political theorist, conduct field work and the language you can use. So that was very interesting for me. What I did notice in terms of diaspora's relations was a set of assumptions that would regularly come up. And there was one particularly telling instance, which isn't in the book. And I was about to start one of the interviews, and it was actually in New York. And it was not long after there was, I forget exactly what had happened. There was some security risk, something had just happened, I think in France or somewhere, I forget. It was quite a few years ago. So I was a little concerned when I was doing the interviews that, okay, let's talk about diaspora's relations, that this event in Israel would make it difficult, that it would the security event in Europe would make it difficult to carry on the conversation, that somehow they would be suspicious. Here is this guy coming from an English university. The building where I based, it's called the Al-Qasimi building. You know, who is this guy coming here to talk about Israel? And that's exactly what happened. That in one instance, the interviewee would say, "Oh yeah, I'm fine. This is fine. I'm, you know, very interested to talk about this. You know, no, we're, you know, because of what happened, we're not really concerned about additional security or security risks, et cetera." But then within about 10, 15 minutes of the interview, that concern it came up exactly as what I was, as what I felt, that, well, because in fact there has been this issue in another country, we, you know, we are on a heightened level of alert. What I found is very interesting was there's both the decision, the conscious decision to dismiss or deny how, you know, attacks on Jews in another country, in another country, increases our sense of insecurity, that we want to deny that while simultaneously acting as if that is the case. And that paradox, I think, is incredibly powerful for how, as diaspora Jews, we understand our relationship with other Jewish communities and with Israel. And it also gets to, I think, the hardest question, which came up through in pretty much every interview, which is, what if Israel is actually making Jews less secure? What if what's going on in Israel is raising Jewish insecurity and is increasing anxiety? And I was very privileged that in all the interviews I had, we were able to talk about that question. It's a very difficult question to I think address, but it was rewarding that I felt very privileged that I could be able to have these conversations with such a range of individuals. I mean, the interviews took place in Canada, on the west coast of Canada, in New York, in London, and also in Israel, and primarily in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem. And one of the other interesting things for me when I was conducting the interviews were the interviews I conducted in Jerusalem and with diplomats there, and how aware they were of exactly that type of issue, and yet how it doesn't really appear that that awareness is filtering outside of those diplomatic circles. I mean, certainly you won't find Israeli politicians speak in those ways, and you would rarely, if ever, find leaders of Jewish communities openly talk about, well, is what's happening in Israel increasing our sense of anxiety and insecurity, and what can we do about that? Usually, you know, because if you ask that question, you're calling into question how important Israel is supposed to be for us as a Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move to chapter 5, which is called Obligation and Critique. I think your conclusion puts your view of what the book is trying to do most clearly. You say, how are we to understand the Jewish diaspora's relationship with Israel when it is no longer appropriate, if it ever was, to presume that to be a good Jew means being a Zionist? What do you mean by that?
So this is part of the I think the controversy, you know, one of the flashpoints, is the assumption about being Jewish and having a tie and having a positive relationship with Israel. And I teach a course at Durham University that's based on this book. And one of the students in the class was mentioning this, how this student felt that the friends the student has, the Jewish friends the student has, all felt they had to have a view about Israel. They had to be very defensive of Israel, but very supportive, that Israel is something to support. And yet, whether or not these friends had the necessary background and necessary knowledge to be able to make educated decisions on that was uncertain. And I think that there's a pressure, certainly I felt it and I've seen it, that there's a pressure to support Israel, and that if you don't, you're open to attack. And sometimes the attack is brutal. It can be very, very vicious. There was one of the synagogues I went to when I was doing the last stages of the research. Some of the congregants there told me they can't talk about Israel. They can't do it. They're worried that they'll be attacked, because that's what happens. You get verbally attacked. And that's not unique. I mean, one of the things that came up repeatedly, particularly in congregations of, I guess, progressive Jews, so not so much the Orthodox Union UK or Orthodox communities in North America, so outside of those communities, is very much a concern that it's really hard to discuss this, that you're just expected to support it, and if you're critical, of Israel in any way, you're opening yourself up to potentially very serious ad hominem attacks where you're self-hating Jew or whatever else. And I think that's a travesty. Morally, I find that very, very painful that it's even possible to make those arguments. I think that one of the great strengths of the Jewish tradition is to be one of critique and open debate. And if we can't critique and discuss the role of Israel in the construction of contemporary diaspora Jewish identity, if we can't openly discuss that and critique it, I don't think we're being true to our tradition. And that's also part of what I'm trying to do in this book, is to open up a space for that discussion so people who feel that they can't speak out because they may be attacked are finding a way to do so. So let's see, do we feel an obligation? Okay, what does that mean? Let's have that conversation about an obligation. And then let's see what happens. And I hope that those conversations are able to happen. I hope that this book can support them in some way. We'll have to see. There is one, also really specifically to that sentence, one of the things about this book that's, I think, very, it's unusual for me, and it gets back to where we start our conversation about how this is a very personal book, is I don't really believe that most social scientific work should just explain. I think that any work that it explains also has a moral inference or a normative dimension to it. It's a methodological position that I quite strongly believe. And yet most of this book is actually explanatory. The normative element doesn't come out very much until the end. And that normative question will be very important for my next project, which I'm working on now, about diaspora responsibility, about political responsibility. But the normative question, what we ought to do, what we should do, and how we're going to relate to Israel is, I think, very, very important. And it is one that we really need to be thinking about, especially today. It's, I think, the situation that the politics of what's going on in Israel is becoming increasingly damaging, not just in Israel, but for the diaspora Jews, right? Where it becomes impossible to have a discussion about Israel because you can be accused of being self-hating wherever else. So the role of critique is key here. It's crucial, and how we accept it and how we create open spaces to enable those critiques to happen without assuming that by being a Jew, you are necessarily a card-carrying Zionist.
Right. Well, Ilan, we've taken up a lot of your time, so any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and maybe tell us, you told us a little bit, but maybe tell us what are you working on next?
Right, so I'm becoming, I've always been interested in the question of political responsibility, and so I'm in the process of developing a research project to explore the question of political responsibility vis-a-vis diaspora Jewry in Israel. It's very much a project in its infancy. I'm still trying to work through exactly what kind of responsibility would be relevant in this case. Who is the object of responsibility? Where are the relations of the political relations in this account of responsibility, and why? One of the things I've done to sort of work through this is I've sort of taken a sidestep away from the political theory literature and away from obligation, and actually started looking at questions about Jewish food and the Israelization of Jewish food. And I've been thinking quite a lot about how various cultural products that come out of Israel are becoming increasingly important in how diaspora Jewish identity is constructed. So that's what I've been working on the most at the moment. And I think then the next step will be to work through this question of international political responsibility. And I'm pretty certain that I will, like I did in this book, we'll use a lot of Hannah Arendt. I think Arendt is actually an incredibly inspiring thinker when we think through these sorts of questions. But also the political thought of other Jewish emigres, Raymond Aron and Hans Morgenthau come to mind because of my work in international relations and international political theory and the significance of those scholars in international politics. And we'll Yeah, we'll see. We'll see where that goes. It's going to be much more of a normative book than Obligation in Exile.
Great. Well, Ilan, I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Obligation in Exile, The Jewish Diaspora, Israel, and Critique, published this year by Edinburgh University Press. The author is Ilan Baron. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us. Check us out at newbooksinjewishstudies.com. You can download the podcast on iTunes, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Judaism. Got an idea for a book we should cover? Send us an email, newbooksinjewishstudies@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.